This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
Find the early adopters is an obvious first step. So do you disagree with that?
I disagree. It's not always the case. So we had early adopters in enterprise and industry and small business. And so we had to decide which one to go with. And all the advice we got was like, let's start with small business. They're the ones that are willing to do as much with you and get your products off the ground. What we found was the way this industry works is if you're a small business vendor, you're in that bucket. You will never deal with enterprise vendors. It's just how they're conditioned. They've been in the industry for many, many years, and they've seen a lot of whimsical things. They never reached that level status of like enterprise grade. We saw that with other companies in the space. They're just like, why don't they ever, what's stopping them from selling enterprise and moving forward? They always seem to be stuck in this one segment. It's not even their choice. It's because they came out in that way. That's how the industry categorizes them. The old saying, you'll never lose your job if you buy an IBM or whatever, right? In those days. Well, that was a very similar thing especially when it comes to technologies that need to be embedded in properties and buildings. Like the average time, one of our hardware products sits on a door is 10 years. And it's like, there's what products in the world sit around for 10 years? Even cars don't sit around that long. And it makes a lot of sense because they invest in its infrastructure and buildings. And they want it to work for a long time, and they don't want it to be high risk because it just needs to be solid so that way, they're not spending all their time just making fundamental stuff work. They're spending their time in improving conditions and experiences inside of buildings. And so we learned very quickly that if we wanted to make this more broader and to make sure this is going to serve the broader market, a lot of that interest that came from us, that we had to get good at both. We had to get good at serving the small businesses, being rapid to evolve that, but also developing DNA and how to make sure we can talk to enterprise customers and actually get them moving forward. And now we do more enterprise deals than small businesses, but that was against the flow kind of decision that we recognize that in the industry. Yeah,
that certainly is atypical, as in not the typical process people go after. And I can't disagree with you. You've done it. It's worked for you. But how do you handle the fact that your early adopters want technology that might not be representative of what the mass market wants or the enterprise companies want, and you also might not be ready to work with an enterprise company? How did you do both? And did you create different products for the two segments and different marketing positioning, or is it the same core product?
It's the same core product, just tweaked for both. And then it's just the approach on how you deal with enterprise customers. So how you spend your time and energy to make sure they can move through the process. So a typical enterprise customer will want to pilot everything and run through a pilot phase and have a checklist of things. And then they want to sort of see SOC 2 compliance. They want to see all the stuff that makes them feel safe and secure to convince their their leadership team and the rest of it to have a budget to spend on this. It was learning how to go through that process. While it's pretty much the same product. Now, there is a difference, in the sense that in enterprise land, most of our deployments are working with existing systems. And that was great. We actually never wanted to do the end-to-end. We never wanted to have to build the server room control system stuff. No, that was not the, intent for us. We only wanted to do the human representation side. How do we represent a human, use their smartphone and do that really well and make this door experience a great one, but let this door experience be reflective. This is just one use case of many. Now that your signal is working, it literally is just getting through the door, and now once you're through the door, you can use this signal in your meeting room, you can use it to log into your computer, you can use it to pay for your coffee. All these things start to come about because now you have a relationship with that end user, and that's how we teed it up. And that's the common thing across enterprises and small business. We have a relationship with every single end user because we're building their signal and they're just using their signal in the workplace. And that's kind of the equation that's kept us in the safe zone of being able to do just the right pieces and not to try to do more than necessary. And we've just found that by not doing the end-to-end, which a lot of startups did before and still do. And they think they have to own the solution. It's my way or the highway. You know, you need all my solutions because I'm trying to make maximum margin for my whole solution. And we're like, no, you don't need all of that stuff. Keep using your stuff. Just do an add-on and it's better priced. And in that way, you know, I have a relationship with the customer and the platform and technology has a relationship to the end user, pretty much your smartphone, to now start representing you. And you only need one signal. You don't need like 10,000 signals. That one signal can become a routing system to query for any information and to pass it through. And you know, we caught onto that very quickly, that there was this common ground between all of them. And if we worked within that region and made sure our products are serving a need for those regions, then we had something that was going to be mass market available in pretty short time. And now we're very much in the deep end of that, working on many multiple verticals that are all coming together, but they're all physical world related. They're all basically how do you interact with your physical environment. And you know what Okta did for software into, you know, creating, you know, managed identities for software, we're pretty much doing for the physical world. And you know, we don't represent one identifier, we can represent any identifier necessary for any system.
Got it. So you touched on something very interesting. You said that your product has potentially a lifespan of 10 plus years. Makes sense. When I buy real estate, I'm looking at a 10-year minimum view. Any less is not really, you know, long-term investment. Real estate is long-term. So it sounds like that's one of the unique things about this industry we're in. If you're in prop tech and you're building a device, that device could potentially be there for years and years, if not a decade plus. No other industry is like that. Well, what else have you noticed about prop tech industry?
It's an industry that wants to move forward and now is moving forward, but it's also, it's kind of like the car business. It's like you can't screw around taking risks all the time. Like you can't have cars falling apart in the middle of the highway. You can't have buildings falling apart. You can't have these are just like really, really has to be stable stuff. But yet the innovation is there to move it forward and to really, you know, make things more efficient and make people experience buildings better. And, you know, that's taken time to get there. It's like the industry is being willing to take new risks and to try new things and to do it in a very, you know, controlled environment. But the industry is also looking at ways to not just be, you know, a square footage vendor, right? And I call it like the new app store is the physical world. Like every building is an experience. Every way you interact with your environment is an experience. That is the new app. You know, the app is no longer inside your screen. The app is the world around you and how you interact with it and how technology works around that. And, you know, I actually think people in properties are sitting on the next big app stores. They're sitting on, hey, what experiences can we create here? What technologies can we bring in? And then what ways can we allow others to innovate through this as well? Kind of like, you know, creating a developer community to do things. And I think that's starting to happen. That's starting to come about, but it hasn't been easy to do because of that sort of nature of like things have to work here. You know, we can't have people locked out of their buildings. Like we have a running joke, you know, how much money can we lose for a business? Well, if you lock out their entire engineering team for a day, calculate the number of hours of lost productivity, and it's like, yeah, you don't want to screw that up. You know, so there are just some fundamentals that you got to get right, but at the same time, the opportunity to move things forward is just tremendous. It really is the fertile ground where if you start to combine technologies and really think about how people experiencing buildings and workplaces and the rest of it, it's really time to change all that up. And, you know, it's a good time, I think, to be in prop tech and to be really sort of seeing it as an opportunity to move things forward. Yeah.
Totally agree. When you said that building owners literally are sitting on the next app store, what does that mean? That's a very interesting concept.
Yeah. So if you think about it, your phone is the real estate right now. Your screen is the real estate, right? So every app developer wants to create some app where they're on your screen and they're doing something useful for you to spend time in it. Now, The equivalent of that is like, think of, you know, the building owner being the phone, right? They have the real estate. You know, you're spending time on there, whether you like it or not, because you're working there or you're basically, you know, there for coffee or lunch or whatever. So this real estate now becomes that environment of saying, okay, well, what applications can we run in this environment? And how do we get developers to build these applications, you know, just like developers building applications on your phone? And when you start to see that way, real estate really is just the environment to innovate in. It's a box, right? Just like the smartphone is a box to innovate in. And that's where I sort of, you know, I've said this to a number of, you know, building owners that, like, you know, you're really sitting on the next big platform, right? You know, if you open up for like innovation to happen here and open up for like, you know, people to see how the user experience can evolve in these environments, you know, especially once AR starts to kick in and everything else, it really becomes that's the platform of the future. And I think we've gone through the peak wave of mobile. Like we've innovated the crap out of the mobile real estate screen experience, you know, and now the phone is becoming an extension of you beyond the internals of the phone. Now it's externally, right? And that's where we sort of, you know, are very much, you know, spending a lot of our time. It's like, okay, how do we represent you in the physical world? Use a smartphone to communicate around you, but see you as a symbiotic system. See you as like, you know, phone and human as one. And then the playground, the sort of environment to innovate is everything else around you. And, you know, that's how we spend all our time innovating and building products. It's like, where can we take the user? Where can we take the experience? And like, how is this useful for businesses? So that way, you know, we can both, you know, create new experiences and businesses can benefit from it, which is like the ultimate machine that kind of is a recursive, you know, algorithm for businesses. Money coming in, invest in more innovation, more money coming in, right? So like that machine is what you want to make sure you build out.
Sure. Dennis, a lot of prop tech entrepreneurs are trying to figure out whether they should bootstrap and remain profitable or even attempt their profitability and slow growth versus go raise venture funding. You've raised how much? Almost $60 million in venture funding?
Yep.
So that was quite a trade-off and a decision to make. Walk me through why you decided to raise that much capital versus other options you had on the table.
Mostly because there's just so much work to do. And like the biggest failure here is not to take on the challenges, right? To be meek on taking on the big challenges. And I figured, well, if we're going to confront such a challenge, you know, how do you represent humans in the physical world? You need to be capitalized to do it because you're going to make a lot of mistakes. You're going to learn things, but you need to make sure you can survive through all those mistakes and survive through all those learnings so you can get to the point where you have something that's sustainable and can move beyond, you know, where it is today. And that's where we knew this is not going to be cheap. It's just like, you know, the Apollo program wasn't going to be cheap, right? Send man to the moon, bring it home safely, not going to be cheap. We're going to have to invent science. We're going to have to invent, you know, materials to do this, you know, and so that very early on that, like, yeah, look, the vision is very long term. It's going to take time to get there, but just the execution of it is hard enough. You know, you're dealing with hardware, software. Like we joke around, we're pushing radio waves, we're pushing bits, we're pushing, you know, electrons, we're pushing everything in all directions, and it all has to come about to just create this one seamless experience for an end user. And it's, you know, crazy complex to pull it all together like that. And it's the thing that makes it work. Is yeah, it takes that kind of commitment to do that. So we recognized that early, and we knew that the worst thing we could do is to not to wholeheartedly take on that challenge and say, well, let's make sure we're taking on this challenge and bringing on the people that can help us really do this, and just be realistic about, like, you're going to make some mistakes along the way. Some things will work, some things won't. You'll learn quickly. But at all times, you know that there's, you know, we don't have to invent an industry. There is industries already out there. They are all looking for a better solution. Just make sure you're the better solution and get there as soon as possible. But, I think, it's never for the amount of money that you raise. It's always for the, you know, what do you want to achieve with this money? It's always the case for me, taking on anyone's money, and maybe it's because I'm a little bit old school. For me, it's more responsibility, and I treat it as a liability. I treat it as like, I've just taken X amount of money from you. I need to make sure I'm turning that money into growing this business. So that way you haven't wasted that money. I haven't wasted that money. I treat that very personal. It's like, it's easy to spend other people's money. It's, you know, if you just treat it as like, hey, I've only got $5 left in my pocket. Do I really need that stuff? Like, do I really need that? No, you quickly get to like, what do you actually need to spend that $5 on? And it goes back to my first ever startup, because I was completely bootstrapped with no outside funding. And as a single founder, every dollar I made, I had to think about how I was going to use this to make my next dollar. And it was just really as simple as that. And this is how naive I was. I didn't know the difference between profit and revenue. I just thought everything was profit. It's like, well, how much money after spending all my expenses and everything do I have left to actually build a business with? And that's the only thing I ever measured. And when I heard others talking about their revenues and stuff, I'm like, damn, how are you pulling that off? So made me actually work on like building profits, you know, rather than just revenue. But it trained me on how to look at capital, look at very much as like, it's a fuel. It's not a destination. So, you know, your destination is where you want to take the vehicle. So, you know, you pick where you want to move this car and you put fuel in there, but you know, you're going to run out of fuel. So you're going to want to make sure this car is heading in the right direction. And you want to turn the steering wheel here and there, but you ultimately know that this fuel is to move things, not to just like burn up in its own environment. So that's how I've always seen. And it's not to say we're going to be, you know, raising more money down the road. I mean, we're still very much early in our cycle of how we're innovating. And, you know, prop tech is like the primary thing that matters to us right now. But very quickly, we're seeing things in transportation. We're seeing things in retail, and especially now with the COVID-19 world, it's what we've seen happen to us is that all the stuff we've had on our roadmap for the future suddenly get massively crunched and say, no, need it now. It's not because you have a choice. It's because now the world needs it off you. And now you need to be providing solutions in this new world. And that's the thing that's kind of like, really got us, you know, from being, you know, working hard to working insane. To like, you know, do double the work or triple the work.
COVID could easily have been an event that may have forced you to retrench because you've been focusing on offices and offices are being hit hard. But you're now saying that, no, there's actually opportunities in other segments and it's forcing us to go there. You've just mentioned public transport, for example, or retail. Yep. You couldn't have done that though if you didn't have the venture funding behind you, right?
Because definitely, yeah.
So having venture funding was an advantage, a strategic advantage. Yeah.
And that was intentional. It was, you know, part of the going into the funding ground is like, look, you know, we've got a beachhead here. We've got a very clear vertical we're going after. But, you know, we're building an identity platform for the physical world, right? First, you're either on that journey or you're not. If you're not on that journey, then you're gonna have a hard time, right? And so, like, you know, selecting the right investors that are part of the journey is one thing. And then saying, look, this is one beachhead, but ultimately here is the data sets of what we have already coming to us. Or going back to that original website where we had those pilots, we had the data sets even back then, saying like, you know, this is not something that we're wishful of. This is getting pulled from us. The only thing is we're not doing it right now. We're not dedicating any time with that. But we know that there's multiple paths to this thing. And you know, it's like, you know, which one of these things are going to end up taking us to the vision sooner rather than later. We don't know which one's going to be more efficient or all the rest of it, but we want to stay flexible along the way. And so we're going to raise a little bit more capital, make sure we have that flexibility. And that's with the, you know, long-term partners that are with us all the way through. And they're willing to say, look, you know, this beachhead might not work, but, you know, if you need to flip and jump into that beachhead, go do it. Don't waste any time. Don't hesitate for a second, because we're all focusing on like, you know, can you take this to where it needs to get to? And, you know, you don't get a lot of luxury there. There's not a lot of, you know, typical, it's mostly just about survival. It's mostly just like, can I just survive the next day? But we very much like have been close to not surviving many times, but at the same time, we always have a way to keep figuring out what it takes to get going, what it takes to like, let's save money not doing that piece, let's focus on doing that piece, let's quickly convince ourselves whether it's working or not, so that way, you know, we're working on the pieces that's actually moving us forward. And you know, that's just a discipline you have to have, because no matter how much money you're raising, and I can say when we got that first check from YC going back way back in the day, that was a $15,000 check.
$15,000 from Y Combinator.
$15,000 from Y Combinator. Back in the days where it used to be based on how many founders were in the team and how much ramen noodle you can eat in 3 months, right? That was the calculation of how much to fund you, you know. But that was like, it was so clear in my head. That's all we needed in those 3 months to survive. Right. And it gave us all the flexibility of saying, okay, if we can prove out this, this, and this in these 3 months, then yes, we can bring in more capital, but at least that capital knows what it's going to be doing. It's going to be helping us move this from this area to that area. So it's not just for the sake of raising capital. And I've always had that since that moment of ever receiving my first check. To even, you know, our recent rounds. So it's like, okay, it's not just about this size of the fund. It's about like, what are we doing with this to move this forward, to increasing our probability of succeeding in moving it forward. And it's never for a second you think like, you know, don't screw it up. You know, don't do something foolish enough where, you know, you're doing whimsical stuff. Like, try to be as disciplined as possible, but also be aggressive in terms of like wanting to achieve. Also be sometimes unrealistic because you just don't know what the limits are. You don't know what's possible or not until you push it, to really, really sort of, you know, push the fundamentals. And so you need to have room to do that. And you know, I try to balance that with like part of our journey of have enough capital but have flexibility, but really drive for insights and understanding of how well this could work, how your business working, and how you can move it forward. And that's probably never going to end. That's probably going to be like, you know, a continuous process. But you know, it's no luxury to have capital. It's a luxury to have options, I would say. But it's what you do with those options, and it's what you do with the capital that makes all the difference. And I've seen plenty of startups that have raised a lot less to do a lot more, right? And that's the thing that you want to balance.